This is EdUp Legal with your host, Deborah Solmore. She's an experienced higher education lawyer, most recently the general counsel for a system of nonprofit institutions, and she's going to be leading conversations about trending legal, regulatory, and compliance matters in higher education, with a focus on leaving out the legalese and making legal easy. Let's hear from your host, Deborah Solmore.
Welcome to another episode of the EdUp Experience Legal Podcast. As promised, today my guest is again Michelle Schuster, the founding partner of McMurray and Schuster. As you may know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about trending issues in advertising and marketing in higher education, and we had so much to talk about and ran out of time, and so I twisted her arm into coming back again so that we could talk today. So welcome back, Michelle. It's great to have you.
Thank you. There was no twisting. We had so much fun the first time, we had to do it a second time. So make no bones about it. No twisting occurred.
All right. Well, I like that version of the story better. So I'm going to go with that. And clearly what you had to say, what we talked about resonated. It's been a great audience, had a lot of people listening to the podcast. So hopefully we will have the same reaction to this one. Last time we spent a lot of time talking about things going on at the federal level, what's going on at the Federal Trade Commission. We talked a little bit about the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, which for those people out there who are listening, because I told you we wouldn't talk like lawyers and we would make legal easy, that is a federal statute. So that is a law that comes out of our federal government. So I thought today you had a great idea, which was to talk about what's going on at the state level, for better or for worse. There's sort of a lot going on down there that I think in the states that people should be paying attention to. So I think we'll start there, if that's okay with you.
Sounds like a great place to start. And actually, you know, as we're starting, we should probably even segue from our last conversation, because the interesting thing about the states, and I can tell you a lot about the states because I'm a former consumer protection chief from the Ohio Attorney General's office, so have a lot of experience in this area. I can tell you that what the states do often mimics what the Federal Trade Commission is doing. And those of you in this space probably know that the Federal Trade Commission is responsible for enforcing its FTC Act. And specifically related to our topic today, it's Section 8 or Section 6 of the FTC Act, which prohibits unfair and deceptive behavior in the marketplace in the area of consumer law. So on the federal level, we have that FTC Act. And then on the state level, and it's usually in the state attorneys general's offices, but there are a few exceptions where the law is enforced by the governor's office or some other state agency, but most often it's the state attorney general's office. They have that same type of authority in their state laws. Usually they're called Consumer Protection Acts, and they also broadly prohibit unfair or deceptive acts or practices in the marketplace by sellers against consumers. And generally, those consumers are defined as people that are purchasing primarily for household or personal reason or family. So really, you know, a consumer product, a consumer purchase type of thing, not B2B. There are, as always, some exceptions. Some states do regulate B2B. But for what we're talking about today, we're talking about that consumer protection authority that the state agencies and the state AGs have that can affect the education space.
It's interesting because when you, as a lawyer, when you read those statutes, they're very broad, and you know they sometimes try to help you and you know give you some sub bullets. This is what this act prohibits, but there are so many things that fall within their jurisdiction that are not enumerated or set forth expressly in their statutes. So I think this is a great topic because I think it can cue people into, you know, one of the mantras that I used to have. Well, I guess I still have it, but probably going on about 10 years old now is two quick questions. You know, is it true and can I prove it? And if you're asking yourself those two questions and the answer is yes, it's true and yes, I can prove it before I say it, that's a really good, in my opinion, sort of, you know, guardrail for people who are putting out marketing and advertising. And if you can do that, then you're really going to fall within the protections of most of these statutes. I don't know. Do you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what the laws say, the term they use is you are required to substantiate any statement you make and that it is true at the time the statement is made. And it can't be that you believe it's true or you talked to 10 friends and they thought it was true too. You have to have something substantial to be able to substantiate that. And generally the standard is, which makes it, you know, all the more clear for companies trying to navigate through the consumer protection laws, it's the standard is the reasonable consumer. And I don't know about you, but I can tell you there aren't a lot of reasonable consumers out there. And so the reasonable consumer is basically what the AG determines is reasonable. And, you know, how you find that is looking through enforcement actions that the AGs have engaged in. Also, most of the AG's offices, if not all of them, have regulations that also shed some light on what those kind of broad laws, as we describe them, cover. So, you know, there could be specific regulations about for-profit schools or the education space or a specific type of statement. The use of social media has become an area where AGs and the FTC, Federal Trade Commission, also has been focusing. But, you know, through all of that, we find out what a reasonable consumer is. And that's where we kind of take a look at, was that statement that we're trying to substantiate actually true? And do we have adequate proof for it?
I'm going to put you on the spot for a second. When we talk about substantiation, and I wholeheartedly agree, one of the things in my practice I've always had to counsel on is, well, from the marketing team side, what does that mean in terms of what should my record look like? So I don't know if you give your clients, I mean, I have some tips, but I'd be really interested to hear, you know, what are some practical guidance you give your clients in terms of if the regulator comes knocking and the lawyer shows up in the marketing department and says, okay, you know, we've been asked to sort of substantiate these statements. When they go to their folders or they get online, what should be in there? What are some practical tips about how do you substantiate?
Yeah.
At the time you make the statement, which I think is a really, you know, sort of put an asterisk there. It's not when they come knocking, gather the evidence. It's before you put it out in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely right. I think a good example in the education space is you see often in advertisements for educational institutions that they have a certain passage rate or they have a certain post-school employment rate or that they have a certain salary that their graduates will usually make on average. And so just looking at those types of things, they all focus on what happens to a student that graduates from that institution. And what you're going to have if you are going to make statements about a percentage that get jobs or the average salary you know, those types of things, you're going to have to actually have hard facts on the students that make up that percentage. So you're going to have to survey a statistically significant amount of graduates and be able to prove that they did make that amount or that they did get a job or they got a job in this certain time period or whatever that statement is that they're trying to substantiate. And I really think there might be some other ways to do it, but that's the only way that I've seen that the AGs have really paid attention to. And I also do know that, you know, when the AGs have gotten involved in this, they have gone back and they have gone through those surveys and they have checked with graduates as well. So, you know, I don't know, in your experience, what types of things have you seen that have been effective?
So I would agree with you. If you're making a statistical claim or a numerical claim, the hard data to back that claim up, the methodology that you used, anything that would explain how you sort of came to that number that's in your claim. You know, one of the other pieces of guidance I would generally give is dating your claim. You know, some schools are better than others at tracking or keeping track of where their claims appear. Is it on a website? Is it in written material? Is it in, you know, a program slick? And if you are not keeping great track of where you have your data or you're doing an audit to refresh your data, you know, one thing I always recommend is claim dating as of this date or an asterisk with the claim, depending on how you want to mark it. So at least there's no question 4 years later about whether that you know, claim in the marketplace is still true and can you prove it? So that's another thing. But I think my guidance is very similar to yours. And, you know, when you're dealing with claims that are not maybe statistic related or numbers related, think about, well, how did I get to this statement? And what can I put in a file that shows that this statement is true and I can prove it? And I think, you know, that's really, we're as usual, the two of us are similarly aligned in guidance that we give.
Yeah, you know, that's really, really great advice there. And, you know, the other thing I would say, there's more than one reason to do exactly what you just said. And that's that, you know, in the consumer protection laws, and especially if you're going to be involved in any type of telemarketing, those laws that apply to those mediums of consumer advertising require that you keep the advertisements that you have put out there in any substantially different versions of those advertisements. And so, as well as dating the claims, you know, keeping that information for when those advertisements ran, so you know what those effective periods were, so you can show that it was still relevant when those were the substantiation that you have is still relevant at the time that you're providing it. So yeah, you know, record keeping so important, it really is. I'll tell you that you know, when we put together a compliance program for our clients, we really focus on that, because the initial assessment we do is usually based on records, interviews as well, of course, but primarily records. And so, you know, we usually find that companies that may have really great compliance practices aren't really great at proving those and having the records to prove them. So it's a good thing to go back and take a look at your own record keeping. And if, you know, God forbid a regulator came knocking on your door, are you going to have the information that you need to show that you were complying with the regulations that they're enforcing?
I'm smiling a little bit because I'm thinking about all the things we talked about we could talk about today, and we're probably about halfway through the podcast and we're off on another great tangent as usual. But sticking with this topic for another second. So when you're advising and helping build compliance programs, how important is, and maybe this is a, you know, a softball or a loaded question, but how important is in building those compliance programs and also building in training, updating policies? You know, I worked a lot with media compliance guidelines, and, you know, they need to be updated, and people who are doing the work need to be able to explain that they're trained as new laws come out, as new, you know, new guidelines, new, you know, information from the Department of Ed or from the FTC or from the states. So how do you approach that when you're building a compliance program?
Yeah. Well, first, I mean, you said the important thing, the regulations are always changing. The AGs or the other regulators' interpretations of the regulations are always changing. And so you have to stay up to date and at a minimum on a monthly basis. So have some type of effective monitoring system to know those regulations are changing. But you know, going back to the training, so staying current with what the regulations say, because you were once compliant, and then something changed the law and interpretation, something like that. The fact that it changed is not going to give you an olly income free for not meeting the requirements of those new regulations. And so you got to monitor to stay on top of them. And then you have to update your compliance materials to make sure that they reflect those changes. And then, like you said, the really critical component is training your personnel on it, because if you don't train your personnel on it, then there's no way you're going to be able to meet those requirements. And then you have to document that you did that training. So everybody that was in that training, they sign a sheet to show that they were there, or electronically, or noted, or you know, you keep the recordings or whatever. But you know, when we go through that process of updating or doing initial assessments, we always end with a training session of the personnel that we are working with, and we record that so that they can use that as their onboarding until, you know, they have their regular checkups and see if anything's changed, and then those types of things can be updated. But yeah, you're absolutely right. This is an area where there is never a board morning. And I say that because the first thing, I don't know if you did this, Deb, too, or still do, you go and you look at all the kind of trade rags that came out the night before and see what's going on. What were the press releases from the AG's office or the Federal Trade Commission or the Federal Communications Commission or the alphabet of federal agencies? And then you look at the cases that have been reported, and it's literally every day there is something new.
Yeah, I call that my morning reading. And I think I attribute my caffeine habit to as more and more things come out that you need to read, my morning reading gets longer, which means I need to refill my coffee cup again. And so I think that's, I'm going to blame my caffeine habit on my morning reading and the government regulators.
Actually, I love this. You might want to use this in the future. You're going to have to, like, you have a scale now for how bad the changes were any given day. You know, it was maybe a half a cup day. Oh, God, today it's a 3-cup day.
So, I'm being serious. Yeah. And particularly since I'm home a lot more now, I mean, it's very easy to just walk in my kitchen and refill my coffee cup. Although today I do have a water bottle. I want to go back to one point you said, because I thought you said something really great that I'm not sure is part of everyone's compliance program, which is the documentation of the people attending the training, right? So I can envision being asked the question, well, how did you train? Oh, well, we held a training on this day. Well, who was there? Oh, I don't know. Let me go back to the calendar invite. Well, these people accepted, but I'm not really sure that they were there. And so having a mechanism to document who was at your training, you know, sort of mind blow moment, it's so easy to do. And it will, you know, it will sort of go a long way to showing the robustness of your training. So I did want to go back and just sort of highlight that one, because that's a great piece of advice.
Yeah. Because inevitably, if you do run into an issue that leads to a complaint to an agency that is now subsequently going to investigate that, then of course the person that slipped up on a phone call or in releasing a print ad, whatever it is, they're going to be the one that missed the training. And you didn't know they missed the training because you didn't track it. So you didn't go back and train them. So inevitably, it's just, Murphy's Law that something like that would happen.
And I think it also bears repeating that in this space, it's really the people, you know, different institutions have different policies about whether legal or compliance has to be involved in approving every message that goes out. I worked at an organization where they did. I worked in an organization where they didn't. And so this is one of those places where I think, right, people carrying out the work, creating the ads, you know, making the claims, really need to keep abreast. It's not one where you pick up the phone and you call legal after the fact and say, oh, can you help me? You know, was this okay? Should I have said this? So I think, you know, it's incumbent upon the people, you know, putting together the content to be part of this great compliance program that you can create.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And get them involved in trade associations that do got a good job on this type of education, you know, make sure they're staying up on their, you know, professional acumen, compliance acumen in the job that they have. And there's lots of great resources out there. Actually, we could spend a whole podcast just on resources, I'm sure.
I would agree. And sort of which ones are geared more towards the lawyers and which ones are geared more towards the industry and sort of, you know, translating, you know, that's kind of one of my hopes on this podcast is that we're translating the legal jargon into things people understand. But I think you're right. There are, you know, groups that do a really nice job of translating.
And the other thing that I would just say about that, you know, staying on top of things, the one thing that I think folks don't do a lot of is that they, in the compliance space, is subscribing to the agency's press releases that are relevant to your job or the regulations that apply to your company. So if you haven't done that, go to those associations, subscribe to the press release. You'll get it whenever anything happens. You'll be the first to know. The Federal Trade Commission, highly recommend it. Your state AG, I highly recommend it. Or find the AGs that are taking the lead on the items that are really affecting your space. So like right now, I would say that if you're doing any type of telemarketing, there is a group called the Anti-Robocall Task Force that is the attorneys general that have banded together with federal agencies to stop illegal robocalls. And they're doing this by, as they would say, regulating with greater intensity the whole ecosystem of telemarketing. And so if you are telemarketing, the states you would really want to pay attention to are the states that are taking the lead in that area. And that would be North Carolina, Ohio, Indiana, Michigan. Those are the ones that if something's going to happen, you're going to find it from their press releases first. So do your research there. See who's usually the AG that's filing a complaint or getting a consent order or those, you know, those types of things.
That's great advice. And on those states, what's going on? Can you give us sort of just a high level overview of what's going on in those states that are putting them in the forefront to all of this?
Yeah, I yeah. So I'm looking at my watch. I'm like, oh my gosh, this is going to be a, we could go on for literally 2 or 3 hours about this.
I was just going to say, people can't see us, but I was going to say, Michelle is just looking at her watch. So
we have 5 minutes, so I'll make this really, really quick. If you look at what they've done, the press releases you would have gotten recently were part of the FTC Stop Spam Calls sweep. Those states were very active in that, and they went after lead generators. And so the lead generators that were probably some of the largest in the space have got consent orders that they have agreed to. So you would have that consent order. You would see in the lead generation space what those AGs and the anti-robocall task force are looking at. You'll also notice that they went after, they took enforcement action against voice service providers and carriers. And so they're looking at how are the leads generated, who's carrying that traffic. And then they also had enforcement actions against the companies that were actually, the telemarketers, or if they were doing it themselves, engaging in the telemarketing. And so it really is that whole ecosystem of folks that are involved in getting a marketing call from a lead all the way to the consumer. So that's just a perfect example. If you're following those states, you'll see what the AGs now believe are the standards, which is kind of brings us full circle, right? We were talking about how those regulations change. Well, it's changed in the telemarketing and lead generation space. And you would know that if you were following these agencies and seeing what they say is a violation of the telemarketing laws or an unfair or deceptive act or practice.
That's great. You know, when we started this morning, I didn't anticipate that we would be sort of giving, you know, a tutorial on how to make sure that you're in the know, how to make sure that you're keeping up with best practices. But I love that's where this conversation has gone. So instead of introducing a whole slew of other topics that we had on our list, maybe we can wrap up by any other sort of, you know, I don't know, pieces of advice for how to stay abreast of these things, because you're right. I mean, I could have you on every single morning. We could do sort of coffee with Deborah and Michelle, and we could talk about a different topic, but you know, people need to, I always feel like, you know, it's the Confucius saying about teaching people to fish instead of giving them a fish. And I think that's what we're doing here, is teaching people how to fish. So any other sort of fishing advice about, and I mean, F-I-S-H-I-N-G, not P.
I could give advice on both, but
that is probably true.
We'll start with the F. So I'm going to say subscribe to, you know, our newsletter, our blogs at mslawgroup.com.
And I will put those in the show notes so that people can get there easily.
Thank you. Like I said, sign up for those press releases, find the trade association that's most relevant to your line of work, become a member. Most of the individual memberships are inexpensive. I would encourage your company to get involved too in those types of trade associations. And, stay connected, network with the people in your industry, because frequently you'll hear about things that are going on because someone who's also in your industry is going to reach out to you and let you know. Folks like to commiserate.
Yes. And I was going to say, you know, trying to attend an in-person conference where you can meet people. I believe one of the big associations, like I know LeadsCon, I think they're meeting here in Chicago at the end of September. So that's one.
Yeah. I'm actually speaking at that, and the Chicago bureau director is going to be doing the fireside chat with me at LeadsCon. So that'll be really interesting.
Oh, wow. Yeah. You know, I was going to say, I know this isn't a plug LeadsCon podcast. So, yeah. You know, Ian McRae, if you're listening, here's a shout out to you. But one of the things that I think is important about what you were talking about is a lot of these conferences are really good at getting the regulators to come speak, which sends this message that the regulators do want to educate. And, you know, if you're not being, too pessimistic, say they want a partner and they want you to understand what it is that they're looking at. And I have seen, you know, the FTC speak. And so it's a great place to really get good information.
Absolutely. They want to get the message out to the industry beforehand. Contrary to popular belief, most regulators do not want gotcha moments. They want industries that are aligned with the law. And so they do that primarily through education. But if education doesn't work, then they'll go do it through enforcement. You know, another conference I would recommend is the PACE ACX. Excellent trade show conference. It'll have a track that is focused on compliance. It's in Charlotte, October 8th through the 10th. So that'd be another good place you could get some educational input.
Well, sadly, I'm going to be out of town for the days of the conference here in my own home city. So I'm going to miss it. But I would urge everyone listening to this podcast, if this is relevant to you, to try and attend that conference, meet Michelle in person and get a chance to hear her. I've spoken on panels with you, Michelle. I've watched your panels. I've seen you moderate. So it'll be a great experience. I'm going to extend the invitation to come back again because this has just been really helpful. And I will put some of those resources in our show notes. And the one thing I do want to close with, we talked about this before we hit record, but another area that people should be looking is, any advertising marketing guidelines issued by higher education state licensing bodies. And, you know, I know for a fact that there are at least some that in their state higher education regulations do have advertising marketing, not all of them. And unless you're looking, you wouldn't know. But if you're advertising in particular states or you have degree authorization in particular states, you should absolutely be checking to see if there's anything out there that's relevant to you.
Great point. Very good point. Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. And I would love to do this again. We'll make this a monthly thing.
Coffee with Deborah and Michelle every month. I would love it. I'm going to hold you to that. Well, have a wonderful day. And as always, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.